Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 68, where we will discuss the 2019 documentary film American Factory, directed by Stephen Bugnar and Julie Reichert, produced by Jeff Reichert and Julie Parker Bonello, and distributed by Netflix. This is part one of the episode where we will focus on the movie itself, about what happened when a Chinese glassmaking firm reopened and repurposed a shuttered General Motors plant in Ohio. This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Ralph calling from the high desert of Albuquerque, New Mexico, also in the United States.
This is Leonardo calling from São Paulo, Brazil.
This is Dimitris coming to you from Kuldīga, Latvia.
Welcome, everybody.
Great to be here.
Great.
Okay, so we have a very interesting episode today. We sort of departed from classic old texts, and we're now looking at a very recent documentary. It's the documentary is titled American Factory, and it's it was filmed last year, in 2019, in fact, and it's distributed by Netflix, directed by Stephen Bugnar and Julia Reichert. And this is about the story of a factory that was closed in Dayton, Ohio, or the areas around Dayton, Ohio in the United States. This was an automotive plant that was closed, and a Chinese auto glass company decided, as part of its strategy to invest in the United States, decides that let's go ahead and, you know, make use of this plant. So 6 years had passed. I guess it was about six or seven years had passed, and the plant was reopened as an automotive glass facility under Fuyo Glass America. I mean, they basically, it was the Fuyo Glass America part of Fuyo Glass, which is originated in Fujian, China. I hope I pronounced that correctly. The whole point of the movie is that it is a fly-on-the-wall style documentary. I mean, this is where the directors shoot massive amounts of footage trying to get the lives and the life and times of the workers, both American and Chinese, while also spending some quality time talking with the management, both on the American side, you know, the managers themselves in the plant in America, but also the Chinese corporate headquarters. Now, originally, the documentary was filmed just to sort of film that kind of, you know, daily life experience. But as the filmmakers realized in the course of going through the footage, they found that there was an incredibly powerful story that they captured in terms of what we might call a cultural divide or a cultural clash between the American workers and their thoughts about work and their lifestyle, etc., compared to their Chinese counterparts, both, again, at the worker level and at the management level. Just to, you know, orient the documentary a little bit, you know, they basically pulled out certain stories about some individuals within the factory that they show, many of them they show from the time in which the factory was opened, when times were very optimistic, everybody was excited, to sort of the middle phase, you know, the honeymoon phase was over. You started to see these cultural differences start to come to the fore, to what was a major narrative element, that being of the plans or the desire for the American workers to unionize, and the ultimate failure to of that movement, in which the workers ultimately voted not to. Throughout, I mean, I think we have a lot to talk about in terms of some of the individual worker experiences. What do we mean by culture clash? Let me open the floor. What do y'all, what did y'all think of it?
So I agree with you, Tom. It was a really interesting way to do the documentary. Very little on-camera presence or even audio of the filmmakers. And it was the people in the work that told the story. And the other part of the conflict I would mention, because of course these things always need some sort of dramatic conflict, and I don't mean that in a bad way, it makes for good documentary, and it was real. The other conflict was the need for profitability, the fact that they were losing money. The chairman comes on and says, from January to October, we've lost $40 million, and there's this pressure to turn it around and to keep the factory going. So that, I think that's also a conflict that exists with the unionization drive. And I also think the unionization drive is just a symbol for other kinds of conflict that you were talking about earlier that were a main part of the story, to understand, oh, yes, we're going to come in at the beginning. They say we're going to come in and we're going to be an American. We're going to be an American factory. It's a little bit more complicated than that. And they show that as the film progresses. What I liked about the workers or participants telling their own story was their voice comes through, you know, what's important to them and how they function and how they deal with the problems. And I recognize that that's edited by the filmmakers, but to the extent that reflects what people said predominantly, it was good. I also like the Chinese proverb, a mountain cannot have two tigers, when they were talking about the challenge with unionization versus management. So I thought it exposed very, very interesting themes, and I watched it a couple times, and I thought it was interesting both times.
Yes, I think the movie, it's very interesting. I really enjoy seeing. And one thing that caught my attention was the idea that we always read about the difference of Western and Eastern management styles, and the interest to see how this is in practice and how this is the source of the conflict, because the Chinese has a style of management and the Americans are used to another one. And for example, the idea of a more paternalistic leadership from the from the side of Chinese, and a more distributed responsibility from the Americans, and how a style of management is emerging from this cultural clash, and how the conflicts are solved and how they are trying to solve the conflicts. This is very interesting.
What I thought was interesting is that it's not necessarily the East versus West management style, at least insofar as we learn about this dichotomy in the business school, where Eastern management style, it tends to be more associated with Japanese and the culture of this lifelong career at an organization and this Bushido ethic almost, and Western style has more to do with management and operations and goals. It's more that the style that I saw in the film that the Chinese part of the company was espousing is the Western style, but of the early 1900s. There is so much there that I saw that reminded me of when we read works on scientific management, and especially Henri Fayol's work that we covered in episode 2, and the emphasis on utter and complete unity at the expense of almost everything else, the emphasis on production targets and meeting those targets, even at the expense of safety, and so on and so forth. So it was almost, it was less in my eyes, the way I saw it, a East versus West thing, and more of a early 1900s versus era that has already had half a century of human relations and industrial relations, experience there.
Right. I think both are there. I agree with Dimitris that's one of the other things I saw as well, that the Chinese are early in their industrialization period. And just like in the United States, they're bringing people in from farms and rural areas and teaching them skills, industrial skills that they've never been exposed to. So I agree there's that. And I think the cultural overlay exists as well. And I found myself wondering in the course of watching the movie, I wonder how that will progress in China. And certainly a large influence is their form of government and the connection between the Communist Party and the workers' unions. And in communist societies, it is often said, we don't need unions because the Communist Party is the union and it looks after workers. And that's a view. And in the United States, I found myself noticing, particularly I was grimacing when the man in the meeting was saying, oh yeah, they were dumping paint down the drain and you could just see it flowing. And that was also characteristic of our early days of manufacturing and scientific management, and not so much the pollution, but this idea that we had different priorities. And it's very clear, as Demetrius notes, that we have different priorities in countries that have been industrialized for 100 years or more.
It's very interesting what the idea of a labor union is, according to this documentary, in China as opposed to America and by extension the Western world. Because when they went to China and they interviewed the representative of the Communist Party, who was also the labor union, sort of a leader of some sort there, and brother-in-law of the chairman of the company, the view he put forward was that, so the company gives employment and livelihood to the people, so the overarching goal is to support and grow the company, because if the company is no longer there, then this livelihood is taken away. And so the compromises and sacrifices to individual freedom, safety, time, and so on and so forth are justified in looking at it through this lens, that, well, if there's no company, everyone's worse off anyway. So it's all about keeping the firm afloat. And that's the kind of the crux of that view that this person espoused of what a union is supposed to be. It's supposed to support workers in supporting the company, not what we see unions doing as protecting employees' rights and lobbying on their behalf.
Right, right. And I also was thinking that there are other models of union employee management relationships that are even different than what we have in the United States, where especially in a company like GM, which is known to have very adversarial relationships with the unions and the workers. In Europe, it's quite a bit differently, particularly in Germany and Switzerland, because they have this idea of apprenticeship. And in many, many German companies, members of the union leadership sit on the board of the company. So they have a very strong interest in the productivity of the company. And I once heard a union activist speak, Tom was in the class with me, and he was lamenting the focus unions have on maximizing the gains for the workers and maximizing their role to support the workers versus recognizing any trade-off with productivity and company success. And that's, it's interesting that our relationships or our concepts of union employee management relations in the United States have gone that direction, whereas in Germany and others, Germany and Switzerland primarily, I think they're probably, but perhaps Scandinavia, it's a little more towards a Chinese model than the American model of independence. I mean, that support the company and productivity overall is important.
Yeah, I was just going to say that you can't really generalize Europe as a whole in that way, because the employee boards in Germany and Switzerland are rather unique to those places, and I think share more with Japan in common than with what I know and what we saw of China. But even then, right. It's definitely not uniform throughout the continent.
Yes, I think we can add on this discussion, it's that this time maybe of Korea too, that there is some similarities about this style of management. But I thought very interesting the idea of a company as a family, because as you saw it, people got married on the company.
That was amazing.
Interesting. That is a kind of celebration of the company. There are songs about the company. There are people only lives for the company. And interesting how the Chinese don't understand that the Americans doesn't understand that kind of concept, and how they are like you're saying, that you have to be grateful for the job. So this is a kind of style of management that I don't know if it's going to last, because they are raising issues that the unions were born to fight against. So maybe they are learning how to unionize too. I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see. before we go any further with the analysis, I'll give a brief overview of the movie, the chronology of the movie, and how it works out. So what you see in the beginning is the closure of the General Motors plant in 2012, I think it was, or 2014. But you see that very sad things. And then you see, as Tom noted, Fu Yao comes in and buys the property and converts it to a glass manufacturing plant. And then you see the challenges of the American management that they brought in, and then working with the Chinese, and them setting up the factory, an entirely different model, bringing in new equipment and new processes. And then you see the Chinese struggling to teach the Americans, and you see some pretty dramatic quality problems early on, and quite a bit of drama when the customers, the other automobile manufacturers in the United States, come to visit, and they have no product to show them because of these quality issues. So you know that's not looking very good. And then you see more of these tensions between the Americans and the Chinese, and the opening of the factory, and that people actually having to get down into business and do things, and the conflicts start coming up. And then you have two main conflicts in the I'd say the middle third of the movie, and that is the need for the plant to be profitable. And they are losing money at the beginning, and the chairman is very concerned. He's also concerned that he has to come visit the factory many times and do the visits. And then you'll see these separate meetings, which is interesting, sort of separate worlds of the Chinese managers, the Chinese workers, and the messages that appeal to them, and then the similar meetings and challenges with the American workers over different issues. And then you have, as Tom noted, the drama, and I mean that in a good way, the issue over the unionization. You know, do employees want to be unionized? The union avoidance consultancy, and they have a secret recording of one of the meetings with no video, and some interesting back and forth questions. And then they have the union vote, and I don't want to give away all the details, but I'll just say there was a vote. And then I thought at the very end of the movie, there's not very many text overs or text messages from the director from the producers, but they're having a conversation about automation in the plant and how it's going to replace employees, and they'll be more profitable. And there's this summary that seems to come from left field for me, and we can talk about it later, but this idea about how many workers in the world are going to be replaced by robots, and how that's going to be a defining issue in the future of business. And I was just thinking, where did that come from? Because it really wasn't an earlier focus of the movie. It was in the background, but there's time to talk about it. And that's essentially how the movie lays out.
Yeah, I had the same idea. I was like, why are you talking about this when the whole movie was about that? And then I thought that they're probably setting up a third film, because this is actually a second documentary series.
Oh, I didn't realize
so
that.
The first one was about that plant that closed. That was shown at the beginning of the film. And so this is kind of a follow-up on the same area, same-ish situation. So I don't know. Seems like they're setting up part three in a way, but I also thought that it's really bizarre.
Yeah, it could be a teaser, yeah.
But it seems like the directors are saying that all workers are equal when automation comes in. So everybody will lose their job. So this is a threat for everybody. It doesn't matter how's your opinion about unions. Maybe this is a way out to this situation. I don't know.
Right. Well, and it will be an interesting third part if that's what they cover, because according to economists, that's a great thing. Because it makes products less expensive and you get more of them, and it's development. And at the human level, it changes the nature of work quite a bit. And the people who could come into a factory like Fu Yao's or GM's and not have many skills and just go to work on the production line aren't as capable or aren't as readily insertable in a factory that's highly automated, because then there's quite a bit of skills in working with the robots or repairing robots, and even for the small number of people. So it really changes the nature of work. And it's... You can hear people say, people just need to get retrained. That's not what I've seen. What I've read about is the people that had those, you know, didn't have high skills aren't able to compete for those jobs. So they don't come back when they're laid off. So that's a challenge. I don't want to get too far off topic, but that's a challenge for, future.
Just to add something, it's interesting in the movie how they are the managers, when they are showing the robots, they are saying not about the gains of productivity, but how many workers can be replaced by that robot.
Yes, interesting focus.
Yeah, and speaking of the workers, though, there is another layer in the plot of the documentary, if you will, that the documentary goes through sort of like the changes that went through several of the workers. I mean, it focused on some particular stories.
Right.
Probably the most compelling was the pairing of Rob, who was, I forget what his specific role was.
He was the furnace supervisor, there we are. I think.
Yeah, furnace supervisor. And he was paired with a Chinese furnace supervisor by the name of Wong, who was brought in from
the furnace engineer.
Yeah, and they developed a particular bond to the point where Rob was looking at Wong as almost a brother, had him over to his house, taught him how to shoot, and that sort of thing. They were very close, and they worked very, very well together. However, at some point, you know, during this this later part of the documentary, it became apparent that once the firm decided that it was going to automate, Rob became expendable. So in the end, Rob loses the job, Wong stays on and brings his family over from China. But there are a couple of other compelling ones because, you know, all of the Americans here that they portrayed had some ties to the GM plant. And so when the plant closed in 2008 and there was this 6-year, 7-year gap, many of them simply could not get other work. So the start of the story was very touching, considering, you know, that they felt down, they ran into financial difficulties, they had all of these challenges. Now the factory opens and here's this great opportunity. You know, you look at this is a great opportunity for people to get back into their lives and, you know, back into their former lives, only to realize, you know, first off, they're being pushed to work harder than they were accustomed to for far less pay. I mean, the quota figure was like $29 as a GM worker, $12.84 starter as a Fuya worker. And there's all of these the other types of clashes come in terms of frustration and how to deal with the Chinese managers. Because, like, sort of putting this culture clash into context, American workers are accustomed to sort of having a voice in decisions, or at least asking why. Why do you want me to do something? The Chinese managers, you know, and this was demonstrated and was also presented as sort of the American, you know, as various American reactions was to how Chinese managers are just accustomed to saying, do this and walk away. No questioning, just obedience. And so that actually became a flashpoint in one very quick snippet in the middle where you had that one worker who broke down and cried because she couldn't take it anymore. I mean, it was like after a series of such beratings from what she perceived as beratings from the management. But that was just an example of overall challenges with accepting the Chinese way of doing business, to the point where we follow the story of one woman who actually became a very active voice in the unionization movement, only to basically get once the vote was over, first thing that happens is she's gone. She just gets dismissed.
Right. I thought that was one of the most interesting stories because they go into detail about how she couldn't get work and she lost her house and was living in her sister's basement and felt this isolation and alienation perhaps from her prior life. And then she gets this job and then deals with the difficulties at work. But then they show her moving into a new apartment and feeling like she was starting over and had things that were her own. And then, like you said, then they show her in the scrap area, knocking over bins to take out her frustrations and also responding to things where the manager said, oh yeah, you have to pick two of these things up. And she said, no, it's not safe. It's not safe to do that. And not getting a very good reaction on that. And then she becomes a union activist and it's not clear whether that was before or after she got fired. And that was an interesting, I think that was a very interesting story, and one of the more complete ones that they told in the course of the cameo she was in.
Yeah, not to forget the stories of Chinese workers that are also highlighted, that they're uprooted from where they're from for, I think it was 2 or 2.5 years, and then they have to go to this plant in Ohio. It's not that they're selected or they volunteer, but it's framed as they have to. They just take them and then they send them there. And then right around the time when they were showing this woman that you were just talking about getting her new apartment and decorating, and we see that this new beginning, or this attempt at a new beginning, they also showed these four Chinese guys, all of whom have children, or most anyway, including Wong, just eating something canned out of a communal kitchen, and that's their reality and the way that they're living. And I thought that was really good that they really emphasized the two parts of this whole story. That, yeah,
yes. Speaking of the Chinese part, it's interesting to talk about the Chinese plant of the company, because it's how the Americans get scared about the military discipline that there is in place.
Oh, that was so funny.
How people are working on spot. Yes, it's because the workers are numbers. It's interesting. There are 19 workers that in a line. They say their numbers, and it's like an army. Yes, and by the other side, how the Chinese doesn't understand why Americans don't work all week long. So it's another cultural clash, but it is also an example of regulational clash, let's say this way, because it's interesting how it's a global company, and I think how they doesn't fit by the rules of the place that they are setting in. I just remember an example about the fire alarm. It's an awkward moment, because the CEO arrives at the plant, and he wants to change the fire alarm from the wall, put more near the ground, and the American managers say that the regulation of the United States that doesn't allow that, and the CEO say that they have to think before act, but it's a matter of regulation. You have to accept that it's not something that you can change.
Right, and I was thinking that illustrates very clearly that he's not used to being told no, that you can't do that, or that's per code. Because I mean, I thought what it was on the video, he responded pretty well. But Leonardo, I want to go back to what you mentioned, that the very military-like assembly or roll call of the Chinese workers at the beginning of shift. Because as I'm watching them assemble, I'm thinking, oh, okay, they might do some exercise. They're going to have some advice given to them or something, and they were doing what military is called dressing right, or dressing their formation. That is super military, and I recognize what they were doing, but it was I've done it many times before, but I was thinking, wow, that is amazing. And then what I thought was a way to really encapsulate the differences is Kurt, the American who's with them, who's observing and can speak Chinese and is talking. He has a very interesting conversation with a Chinese supervisor in the Chinese plant. He tries the same thing in the factory, and he's struggling just to get people to get in a line in apparently someplace where there are numbers. You say, hey, Bob, could you move over to number 2 today? And so he's just trying to get him to do that. And
so
you see that
That's
comparison.
So funny,
yeah. It was really, really a good way to see that, that difference in a very visual and dramatic way.
That dude went collective way too quick.
Exactly.
He loved every second of it, seemed like, observing this militaristic type of organization. But then he comes back. Yeah, I really enjoyed that scene. So he witnesses this formation, and the Chinese workers, they do it well, and then they kind of do a little bit of a motivational cheer and get to work. And then he takes it back, and he tries to arrange his own work group. And as one thing, as you just pointed out, Ralph, he would say, hey, name, go to number, whereas that wasn't the case in Chinese. They just go by number to begin with. So there's this just juxtaposition, and then they're all just standing there looking at him annoyed and awkward.
Yes, yes.
And instead of doing anything to boost morale or to reinforce the sense of collectivity or, you know, this again, anything to do with the militaristic ethos, he just kind of like, so everyone's got their protective goggles, everything's working, all right, cool, so let's have a good day. And just people wander off really, really demoralized, if anything, by this performance.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things that was crossing my mind as I cringed through that entire scene is, you know, how often do we see like managers bringing back some sort of a, you know, new shiny object, a new idea, a new fad, and try to impose it immediately, literally, unto their own organizations. I mean, I saw that as a metaphor for some of the other things I've seen where managers
yes.
essentially are, they begin from a position of being out of touch with their own workforce or their own subordinates. And it's just made worse by such a, you know, what almost felt to me like was a desperate attempt to either get in touch or to impose their will
right.
on the subordinates.
Right. And I think it encapsulates these differences of perceptions people have of the worker through this very stark difference. And you hear early in the movie that the Chinese view the American says, particularly the manager, soft, they're lazy, they don't want to work hard, you can't order them to work overtime. No, because that just doesn't, I mean, not only does that not work in our culture, it's not allowed to do that. And then, oh, they feel entitled because as children, they're showered with praise and they're hard to train. And
don't forget that they have fat fingers.
Oh, I forgot about the fat fingers. Yeah, and they also have fat fingers. And then the Americans see the Chinese as they're demanding, they're unreasonable, they're uncaring, they don't appreciate the hard work the people are putting in. And some of that, I think, is longing for the management that they saw at GM or some other things that they've seen. And you see some of those things borne out by the comments of some of the workers. So it's not, they're not entirely stereotypical. I mean, there is truth to those things. Like Tom was saying, well, yeah, you can go over to the Chinese and see what they're doing and then just transplant that immediately. And I think Demetrius, you were the one that was saying, well, he wasn't even trying to motivate them. He was just trying to get them. At the beginning, he says, oh yes, I brought this over and I think it works well. And then you watch him go through it. And like Tom, you just got to cringe and think, okay, what did you think you were bringing over? Because my favorite guy in that whole line was the big tall man. He's kind of in the middle, and he's got this look on his face like, whatever. Okay, let's get on with this.
Yeah, just to add to this discussion that is not, I think, because the movie starts with a great problem to solve, that is the temperature of the glass. I think this is very interesting because not only all the management issues there to deal with workers and so on, but how it's interesting to know how they are struggle to find how you can make the glass in that kind of environment, let's say this way. And this is one of the things that that is interesting because it shows how difficult it is to transfer process from one line to another. And this is a very classical problem on organizational theory. So, and how they are fighting to make right the temperature of the glass and how many broken glass there are on the way until they find the right temperature.
Right, I think Wong was the guy that summed it up and said, you know, when we have a problem, it's difficult to integrate the ideas people have. I thought that was an important observation that, oh, yes, we have these different cultures and then the language barrier and these ways of solving problems. And that all gets magnified because you have the stress of the problem and the glass is not the high enough quality. And I thought you could expand that into a very long topic or paper discussion, that idea about, as you were saying, Leonardo, something that comes up often in businesses, problem solving and dealing with difficulties, and then this added layer of the language barrier, which they didn't talk about too much, but you know that's there, and these different mindsets about solving problems.
It almost begs a question as to, you know, the part of the going in premise was to try to integrate the American and the Chinese workers. And one may wonder, you know, the natural desire, if you want to integrate, is to put the two side by side. It's actually worth questioning. Perhaps in a similar situation in future, might we consider a different approach? Because Wow. It may have been that as opposed to being completely fully integrated, where things could potentially have gone a little bit, you have these clashes that come up immediately and could, and it appears in the documentary that it completely frustrated getting some problem solved, that maybe just starting off by having differentiated roles but keep them a little bit more homogeneous within the factory might have produced, may have gone at it a little bit more slowly and built time for these cultural connections to build. You wonder if there was if we might consider other ways of doing what they were trying to do without being in a rush to show integration.
Yeah, I agree. The idea that you could use different strategies to integrate, I mean, I think as you note, you'd have difficulties long term sustaining that because you just get other difficulties, and you and I have both seen those before in the military. But could you transition to something and make the factory more productive on the earlier stages of the integration? It's an interesting idea for perhaps a different model of integration.
Yeah, because one of the things that I think about with that too is that at some point, obviously, once the profitability of the factory was a challenge, how do you respond to that? And this is where you started to see a little bit of the tension building, where the Chinese are starting to look a little bit more to themselves to lead more and more, and the Americans, especially at the management level, were starting to get pushed out. And it sort of, makes you wonder, especially with the way that the factory started, where you had American leadership at the factory level, what could have been done to keep the management in place, to provide the continuity, to design things a little bit differently so that we didn't have inherent conflict from the beginning. That's kind of what I was thinking about.
Yeah, I think they underemphasized that, what the nature of that problem, and it was, I would like to have seen more, but of course I didn't do the documentary, but from an organizational science perspective, that would have been very interesting as well. What were they doing wrong, or what would the other manager do differently to understand that what was that perceived weakness and that they have to leave? I also thought it was somewhat amusing where I think it was Jeff, the vice president, he had these very strong anti-union sentiments, dropping F-bombs left and right. When Senator Sherrod Brown said, oh yeah, we support, state of Ohio supports the unionization effort.
Right.
And then later in the movie, he's driving around, saying, yeah, I think you need a union because workers need to have a voice. It's like, okay, where did that come from? And I'm not saying it was bad necessarily by the filmmakers, but I'm thinking, all right, so why'd you have this change of heart?
Yeah, not only that, but at the end when he's brought back to essentially give a retrospective look after he's been dismissed, his tone towards the factory was incredibly disparaging. And that to me was very, very, sad because, he was one of the most optimistic figures going into it. And you kind of see how these culture clashes just built up and to the point where he ended up, taking the fall would probably be, one way to look at it. He just basically became part of the overall restructuring. And you feel for the guy. You felt that his dismissal was kind of unfair, but it is what it is.
I really like at the very beginning, there's a scene when the chairman visits, I think, for the first time, and they're taking a walking tour around the premises of the factory with the American leadership. And they're planning for the grand opening ceremony that Ralph mentioned, that later the politician messed things up a little bit on the union part. So anyway, and there, remember, they're walking around and the Americans are showing the chairman, which, by the way, a great way to refer to the CEO of that particular organization. They're showing him like, this is that, this is where we're going to put it up. And then the guy points at some hangar door in the distance and says, well, this should be pointing a different way. And they're like, well, it's going to cost $35,000 to fix. And now it's their fault that it's pointing the wrong way. And then they're asking, shall we, they're telling him that they want to install roofing over the stage that's going to house the the speakers for the grand opening. And he's like, no need, it's not going to rain in October. And this guy hasn't lived there. He has no basis for saying that. But you can just... The dual paradox of, on the one hand, saying this is an American company, we don't want any Chinese art here, it should only be represented as an American firm, on the one hand, and on the other hand, just saying, you know, turn this hangar door around, don't need a roof, put fire alarm in a different place where, for no other reason than this person's private preferences, you can see it reflect in the face of the American leadership as they, I think, first realize that this might not be all that it seems, and that it's not actually going to be an American company fully.
Yeah, you could see that recognition dawning or in their eyes and in their faces that, this is going to be a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, the emphasis on aesthetics, you know, the aesthetics and their meaning was very, very strong. And one of the clear symbols of that for me was when they put up the company, some sort of a company slogan up at the entrance.
That was great.
With a grammatical error in it. But there was, you know, obviously, if there was, you know, somebody with good English speaking skills that was looking at this would have, pointed out, hey, you need to change that because otherwise it's going to look bad. And it wasn't recognized.
Right. Not until they had it on the wall and they said, uh-oh, we're missing something. I'm thinking, well, where were your checks and balances before that?
Yeah, it's interesting that the guard, I think the doorman maybe, the guard of the door, that shows, that's a missing something there. Yeah. Nobody on the management said, but the guard.
Yeah, that was good.
Let's maybe make a quick mention of the very end where the chairman kind of gives his thoughts on life and such. Remember where he's in the car and he's...
That was good. Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah.
Yes. That would be good.
Yeah, yes. It's interesting because they mentioned the poor past and how they are better now and how it's the result of hard work. Because I think it's very interesting what the chairman, the CEO said, that what's the point of life if not work? I think there is not other thing to do in this life besides work. So just caught my attention because he don't know if the result of this work, he is a sinner or something or something good.
A sinner or a contributor or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually the second of two really interesting but brief reflective moments of the workers. The first one I recall was Wong, when he's talking about he's in the apartment by himself. It's that scene that Demetrius referred to where they had the four people together and they're eating together and he's sitting outside and smoking and he says, when he was a boy, or you know, many years ago, the Chinese people only cared about having enough food to raise their children or have enough money for food to raise their children and survive, essentially. Survival was the goal. And then he said, and now they want it all, which I thought was interesting. And then he explains all. They want to travel. They want to buy things. And so he's showing this development of how industrialization and more money and capability changes people. And then near the very end of the movie, they had this very interesting reflective period of the chairman, and he was thinking about what it was like when he was a boy, and he was wondering about how they don't have as many birds and insects chirping, and he's built all these factories, and now you can't hear that. And yes, he has that observation about, he says, I only think like this when I'm, I think he said it was his sad,
yeah, when I'm sad, or something. That's great.
That. When I'm sad. And then he finishes with that quote that Leonardo mentions, am I a sinner or am I a saint or a contributor and these kind of things. And then, the whole point of life is to work. And boy, and that one sentence encapsulates the essence of the difference between Taylorism and early industrialization and Chinese culture and American culture and American development of an industrial model. It was maybe not a summary, but it was a nice, once you'd seen the movie, you say, yep, there's a lot to that statement.
Yeah, I when I was reflecting earlier today on this film, I thought that back, many years ago, when I was learning about the different systems of capitalism, and so on and so forth, it was difficult for me to conceptualize what Chinese economic system really was, that we read and learn about, that it's a cross or a hybrid between capitalism and at least attempted socialism or some form of communism. But you don't really understand it that easily, at least without sufficient context. And I think this film should accompany any teaching that delves into this area, because what I saw throughout these 2 hours, and especially so well highlighted by the chairman at the end, is what happens when you take communist ethos and divorce it from communist ideology, and even worse, so replace that with a capitalist ideology, and you have a large society of people who are subscribing to the idea that you live to work, to make things better, to, you know, raise your children, yes, but also to do it through work. It's a weird form of Protestant ethic on steroids. But then you put a person in charge who drives all this work towards profits. Because he talks about hard work, and he talks about point of life being work, and so on and so forth. But we see Wong and his colleagues live in an empty apartment in a foreign land, separated from their families, while he is flying around in a private jet and driving around in a pretty fancy car. So that I think is highly illustrative of what the whole situation is and how it is and what happens rather when you take a workforce like that and you put it under a system that has no checks and balances that we have now developed through labor unions and regulation.
And actually, it's a fundamental part of our form of government, this idea that, yes, you'll have these conflicts, and then we can resolve them. Because we had terrible union riots and labor unrest in the 20s and 30s. And it's part of our system. Some would argue it doesn't do it well enough, and that's a fine argument. But it's part of our system to manage to resolve those conflicts in a democratic fashion, whereas in China, it's an authoritarian approach, and so it'll be interesting to see how this evolves when, as you said, Demetrius, they lack that level of participation in change and in the government, and what that spells for the future of the governance model or the Chinese. You can't really tell by this little snapshot, but it's not as simple as saying, well, okay, well, they were just early in development and they'll in industrial policy and they'll change. It'll be interesting. I don't know how.
Yeah, it will. Because we also started our industrial management from the same perspective. Just we learned that management does not always know best. And more importantly, management does not always care best. And we have adopted to that reality. The Chinese parts of this documentary show the level of naivete that we read in the principles of scientific management, where, hey, why are they unhappy if we're paying them more money or if they're being more productive and earning more money? That this makes no sense. And at one point when the chairman was reflecting on why the American leadership failed, he said something to the tune of, well, we thought if we get a bunch of Americans to lead and pay them a lot of money, they will do things effectively in the best interest of the company, and they didn't. And I wonder why that is so.
Right. He was profoundly perplexed. Why would that happen? And that's why I like your description, Demetrius, and saying it should be required viewing for people understanding Taylorism and original models of industrialization, because it's one thing to read about it, and you can read Taylor saying, I don't understand why we're having these difficulties, or people that want more say in what's going on. And it's another thing to actually see it going on and seeing what the workers are saying and the manager being perplexed. So that, I think it fleshes that out from just something you read about and say, oh, okay, the Chinese have a different model, and you see how it operates. So that's a really good observation.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening.
We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Now, did you know that we are quickly approaching our fifth anniversary? 5 years and still going strong. We invite you to be part of the celebration. Go to our pages on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, or our website for information about how you can contribute to a series of special releases we will run in October 2020. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time here on Talking About Organizations.